having the processes, having the automation tools, et cetera, absolutely key to building a scalable large company. Controls and compliance, especially in a tough environment, super important. Ensuring our audits are completely clean, you know, we're doing the 409As or insurance or security or our data privacy, all of these things, absolutely essential. And the way I've tended to manage companies, I mean, even private companies, is I run the company as if it's a public company.
Welcome to Recession Proof, a podcast by Ramp. Join us for in-depth, thought-provoking conversations with finance leaders, executives, and investors on the current state of the market and what this means for your business through 2022 and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Song. Anup, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
Alex, thanks for having me. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know it's getting close to quarter end. So I know that you probably got a million things happening all at the same time. So really, really appreciate you being here. I know we've got a ton that we want to talk about. Some of it is going to be very macro related, very, you know, kind of relevant and timely to what probably a lot of our listeners are wondering about. And some of it is going to just be a deep dive into your career, your experiences, and just advice that you may be able to offer to, you know, folks like myself and folks who are listening to our podcast right now. So would love just to dive in.
Sure. Happy to. Let's do it.
So maybe for a brief introduction, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your own career trajectory, your own background, and some of the stops that you've made along the way?
Sure. Yeah, no, happy to. So I've been in Silicon Valley now for just over 25 years. The last 3.5 years at Illumio. Illumio is a late stage Series F cybersecurity company. We are the leader in zero trust segmentation. So essentially the containment of breaches. So we stop the spread of ransomware and bad things from happening to companies. Prior to Illumio, I was CFO at Anaplan, CFO at Nimble Storage. I actually took Nimble through its IPO, and I was the CFO of Nimble until they got acquired and is now a part of HPE. Before that, I spent time as CFO at Clearwell Systems, CFO at Asurion. I was in senior leadership jobs at Trimble, Excited Home, 3Com. And earlier on, I was actually in public accounting. So I started off at Ernst & Young in the UK, EY in the London office, then EY in San Jose for a short time. I was educated in England. Now, you know, the Bay Area is home. I'm married with two kids, and it's a great, great environment and place to be. So that's a little bit about me.
That's awesome. Here's what I'm hearing. A very long and illustrious career, a ton of experiences along the way involving at least one acquisition is what I heard.
Quite a few, yeah.
An IPO, and obviously, you know, quite a tremendous wealth of experience. I know that there's going to be a lot that we can talk about, you know, over the next, you know, 30, 40 minutes or so. This is awesome. Why don't we start with at the very beginning? What got you interested? What got you interested in finance, public accounting? How did you know that the CFO path was the right one for you?
Yeah. So look, I think early on, I had an interest in the business world, the finance world. Of course, I did not have any clue about the CFO role. Actually, I did a degree in economics, a master's in economics. I'm a chartered accountant, you know, which I did afterwards. So I knew I was going down the path of something in business, something in finance. I have got a lot of gratification and personal excitement just from going into high growth, you know, largely tech companies and helping them to scale, helping them to build. And, you know, that's the passion I have. And that's the energy that gets me out of bed every morning to come to work at Illumio and all the companies I've been in the past to know that, you know, I'm taking a company from 10 million to 100 million to 500 million in revenue. And scaling that business at a global level.
Yep, absolutely. So here's what's interesting, right? I mean, I think a lot of our listeners probably know Anaplan, right?
Yep.
We're finance guys. You know, a lot of us are probably thinking about how do we level up the organization? How do we get ourselves public market ready? But a lot of people probably are not familiar with some of these other places that you've worked in the past. Did you have a specific, you know, industry that you wanted to go into? Is there, you know, anything that you in particular wanted to go after? Or was it, you know, you liked the job of running finance, of leading through the growth? What was it?
No, look, I think I've taken a highly selective approach to companies I've joined. You know, the common trend, all of these have been technology companies. These have been high growth companies. So there's a set of commonalities that, you know, the companies I've joined all have. But essentially, you know, so being the geeky finance guy that I am, I have a list of criteria on a spreadsheet against which I grade opportunities. And there are three primary things I remember I tend to consider as I look at opportunities, right? Number one is the product or the technology. So is this something that is disruptive? Is this a game changer? I try to stay away from companies that are a me too from a technology or a product standpoint, right? So I look for companies that are doing things in a different way, solving hard problems, being disruptive, you know, cheaper, faster, superior. So the technology is really important to me. So that's one. Two is the market opportunity, right? How big is the TAM? How big is the market, the addressable, you know, the market? Because it tells me, can this become a really large company? You know, can the opportunity be massive? Can the company really grow, scale? Is there a demand for the products, for the solution that you sell? So, you know, how big is the market? And then number three is team, quality of team. And by team, I mean, you know, who are the investors in this company? Who are the board of directors? You know, who's the executive team? So, you know, these are the key stakeholders that I tend to work with day in and day out. And for me, I look for companies that have high caliber teams across all of these tiers, right? So it's a combination of having a disruptive platform or technology, addressing a market that's huge, substantial, a big problem, and then having a high quality team, investors, board, stakeholders in order to execute against that. So I go down this sort of checklist of criteria I have, and that's how I've tended to choose, you know, the companies I've been to in the past. And good news for me is that it's worked out so far.
I like it. Spoken like a true finance guy, right? Put an investment framework around the whole thing, right? High quality management team, big TAM, disruptive technology. I love it.
Yep.
That's awesome. Switching gears a little bit. You've been around the block, right? You've had the fortune and misfortune.
The great show shows it.
You've had the great fortune and maybe misfortune of being, you know, having seen a couple different business cycles now, right?
Yeah.
A couple different recessions, great financial crisis, .com, et cetera. Would love to hear your opinion and just your observation about the current, I don't know what to even call it. Maybe it's a recession. Maybe it's just market volatility. Maybe it's just a slowdown. Any advice or any observation about what we're seeing today and how it compares to your experiences in the past?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And as you said, I've had the experience of going through these cycles, I guess I'll call it, in the market. We have real companies and businesses, you know, that are generating, you know, real sales and margins and profits in several cases. And so, you know, the advice or I guess commentary I would give around the current environment is we've seen the recommendations from some of the top VC firms, right, to cut back and be very careful in terms of how much you invest and make sure you get to cash flow, you know, to break even and generate, you know, EBITDA and all that sort of stuff. I would say absolutely the viability and survival of your company is most essential. So having cash on the balance sheet, having liquidity, having, you know, 3 to 4 years of cash is sort of the benchmark I look at. You make sure you have the runway to get through this period of time and to emerge super strong on the other side. Because something we have seen, Alex, is that, you know, sometimes having a tough economic environment can be an opportunity as well. You know, you look back at, say, you know, some companies like Amazon, eBay, Google came out of the dot-com era actually stronger and, you know, have grown to be large, enduring companies and franchises. So And more recently, companies like Airbnb, you know, have done a retooling of their business and have emerged, you know, incredibly strong. So I think it is an opportunity for companies, as long as you have the liquidity I talked about, right? 3 to 4 years of cash on the balance sheet, that this is the time to really evaluate your business. Certainly you can do a cutback of the fat, right? You can trim the fat, you know, look at unnecessary investments, expenses. But as long as your business is fundamentally solid, and by that, you know, we look at a ton of KPIs and metrics, and I can go into that in a bit more detail at a later stage. But this is the time to perhaps invest more in innovation, you know, invest in R&D. We have seen some smaller companies or companies that aren't as important in the marketplace be absorbed or they've gone away. So from a customer standpoint, the distraction probably is less in the marketplace. And if you were able to sell, which you should, demonstrating the value you bring to customers in this time. And again, it could be that the ROI from, you know, the solution you sell, and you can say I'm cheaper, faster, and better. And therefore, it's an opportunity to land, to expand, and to really grow your business during a tough time. So I actually see this time for companies that are structurally sound. And by structurally sound, I mean, you've got, you know, the margins are healthy from a gross margin sort of standpoint. You're looking at metrics like LTV to CAC and payback period and these kinds of things. And you know your investments are working, that it could be an opportunity actually to gain share and get even stronger as long as you have that liquidity to come out through the other side of this.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let me ask you this, right? Just very tactically, it sounds like, you know, Illumio, well-funded, cybersecurity-focused company, which presumably is going to be pretty robust, right? Through up cycles and down cycles and whatnot. Would love to hear a little bit about your day-to-day today, right? In terms of managing your company through market volatility or a potential recession, you know, how are you splitting the pie of how you're spending your time? Is it hiring? Is it cost cutting? Is it thinking about acquisition opportunities?
Yeah.
You know, where would you say is kind of the division of labor and bandwidth for yourself right now?
Yeah, no, I will get to that question on time and where I spend it. I think the point I would make about I think in a recession, that depending on the depth and the duration of that recession, right? I think it impacts everybody because you're going to hear that, you know, that deals are taking longer to close or maybe they're slipping from one quarter to another because another signature is required on the purchase order, as an example, right? So even though obviously we are fortunate to be in an industry that is a recession proof to some extent in this environment, but still the customers that we have obviously are very cautious regarding the money they have to spend, the budgets and so forth. And so we're very careful in terms of the metrics. Like we look at, you know, the pipeline as an example every single day to see how is the pipeline evolving? How is it changing? Again, you know, what is the sales cycle or deals taking longer to close and so on. And the way I have always tended to run the companies I'm in, which kind of gets to somewhat how I spend time in the business, is we build our annual operating plan as most companies do at the start of the year. But then we manage the company in real time. I mean, we really do. And we're very much a data-driven environment, you know, culture of data-driven. And we're basically tuning the knob, you know, as we go. So if I see, for example, that hey, the pipeline is growing and we see some acceleration of sales, then we step on the gas and, you know, invest a bit more in sales and go to market and expansion opportunities. If we see the market becoming a bit tighter, it's harder, you know, the pipeline is slowing, deals are slipping, then we do the reverse. And maybe, you know, we're a bit more cautious in terms of how much we lean in and lean forward and so on, right? So we manage the company in real time against the objectives we have for, you know, the revenue numbers, the margin numbers, the cash, you know, the numbers for the company and so on. At the end of the day, you know, the time I think any CFO, invest in the business is divided up into a bunch of different areas. And it comes down ultimately to how do I see the role of the CFO in a company? And this could be during a tough economic environment, or it could be just in a normal environment, right? Number one is supporting the business. It's really partnership with the business. So I talk to our CRO, I talk to our head of product and engineering all the time. We're looking to say, okay, you know, how should we look at these international expansion opportunities? Should we be increasing in breadth or depth our international investments? How do I do the design of plans and quotas and comp plans for the teams that we are bringing on board? Engineering, how do we do a stand-up of our data center? You know, looking at AWS as compared to colo opportunities. So supporting the business is absolutely something I spend a chunk of time on, and my team also is spending a chunk of their time. Number two is, you know, we own the financial model. We own the business and financial, you know, model. So it's the managing of cash flow, it's the managing of our expenses or gross margins, all the rest of it. Number three is a scalable infrastructure, right? I see it here as we're trying to build a skyscraper at Illumio and basically all of these high growth companies I've talked about. In order for you to build a skyscraper, you need to have a foundation that is really strong. Because if not, Alex, then as you add floors onto that, you know, skyscraper, it's going to wobble. It's going to shake. It's going to be the Salesforce Tower. So essentially, you need a foundation of, you know, automation of processes. The quote to cash, order to cash, you know, needs to be automated. You know, the purchase to pay, hire to retire, etc. And so, having the processes, having the automation tools, etc., absolutely key to building a scalable large company. Controls and compliance, especially in a tough environment, super important, right? And that is number four. Ensuring our audits are completely clean, you know, we're doing the 409As or insurance or security or our data privacy, all of these things, absolutely essential. And the way I've tended to manage companies, I mean, even private companies, is I run the company as if it's a public company. So, you know, we close the books in 1 week, as an example. You know, we've got our board meeting in week three after the end of quarter, which is the same sort of cadence I would be on if it was a public company. So, you know, we have our processes, the reporting, et cetera, as a public company. And last but not least, it's building a world-class team, you know, and that is where I spend a chunk of my time, because I think the hiring, the coaching, the mentoring, the development of great teams is arguably the most important thing a leader does. And certainly it's the most important thing I do, is the building and leading of great teams. And regardless of the environment, but I think especially during a tough environment in which there is greater uncertainty inside the company, outside the company, you know, everyone is concerned, and, you know, they're concerned about the COVID situation, they're concerned about the war that's going on, they're concerned about, you know, the politics in the country, whatever it may be. But I think demonstrating a great deal of empathy and being able to coach and manage and help, you know, your employees through this period of time, absolutely the role of every leader. So in a nutshell, all of those areas, right? The partnering, you know, with the business, controlling the model, owning and managing the financial model, the scalable infrastructure, controls and compliance, and the building and leading a world-class team is the stuff I spend all my day doing.
I love it. I love it. I mean, there's obviously a lot to unpack, but I think a lot of that definitely resonates with me personally, as well as I'm sure most of the team here at Ramp. I mean, the automation, the controls framework, right? Making sure that you're able to do things quickly, accurately, you're able to automate processes. You know, hopefully that resonates with, you know, our customers and our listeners. But I mean, moreover, I just think the most important observation to underscore is just the finance function, right, has always been extremely important. I think we can both agree on that.
Yeah.
But in today's environment, that's probably even more so, right? I think there's ever more need for, you know, incremental guidance from a strategic perspective and a tactical perspective. Yeah, that's very, very cool. I want to switch gears a little bit. I would be very remiss if I didn't, you know, spend at least some time delving into this topic. IPO readiness.
Yes.
So you've both sold companies in the past. You've also taken companies public. Would love to hear some of your thoughts there about how it all went down, what happened, any best practices, any key learnings that you might have, and just run us through, you know, getting a company through the IPO process.
Yeah. So look, I mean, the IPO is a transaction. It is just a milestone along the journey of growing and building a business, which is the most important thing. And that is the thing, I guess, employees and executives should consider that, sure, you go to bed the night, you know, so before the IPO as a private company, you wake up the next day and you become a public company and you're trading your stock every day. But that's when the hard, you know, work really starts, right? Is because all of a sudden, as I said, you now are, you know, graded and measured on a daily basis in the public markets. The actual process of doing the IPO, look, there are lots of conferences and materials and information out there, but it's not, in my opinion, it's not any type of, you know, a rocket science event. It's the things I talked about earlier on, Alex, which is having the scalable processes inside of your business, having the controls and compliance, having a great set of advisors to help you on the journey, right? I've been a fan early on of selecting the best advisors early. Even though it may cost you a bit more, I always have said, you know what, I'm going to go with that, you know, big four audit firm early on in the process from day one, ensure I have really clean audits and financials, no issues from a RevRec standpoint, you know, whatever it is, whoever is doing, you know, the 409A, whoever is my insurance, whoever is, you know, investment bankers I use, you know, it's usually the top tier of invest. So I, similar to how I believe in building a world-class team inside of my organization, and, you know, here is a fun, you know, I guess, anecdote. I remember when I was at, you know, at Nimble Storage and I was doing the IPO. For me, it was the first time. I had not sort of gone through that process before. So I did two things to really to grow and to learn the process. The first thing was I did a ton of homework. I remember I scheduled probably a dozen or so, you know, coffee meetings or breakfast or lunches with CFOs and others who had gone through the process. And I went with my, you know, questions in a notebook, and I asked them, you know, who is the research analyst you think, you know, understands the space and, you know, you recommend, you like. And so I did a lot of, you know, I would get on the internet at night and I would listen to earnings calls, right? You know, just to understand the cadence of an earnings call and the types of questions and the responses. So it's doing your homework, doing the prep. So, and then the second thing I did was everyone on my team, all of my key team players, you know, controller, GC, FP&A head, IT head, all of those people on my team had gone through an IPO before. So I hired this team and built this team of people who had seen scale. They had seen companies transition from a private to a public company, understanding the scale, understanding the requirements to go through that. And so I had this great group of people surrounding the table, you know, around the table helping me. And that is a classic real-time example of you don't need to be the smartest guy in the room. As a matter of fact, you shouldn't be the smartest individual in a room. Surround yourself with really, really smart, great people with great experience, and it's all going to go really well. So I think having the controls and compliance, having the scalable automation, and that great team, I cannot say it enough, of people who had seen scale, had done it before, you know, super, super important. And then, of course, the most important thing I think you need to be able to do, if it's the one thing, is understand how to forecast your business, right? So FP&A, highly, highly important, because the very last thing you want to do is to come out the gate and after a quarter or two or three is to miss your number. You don't want, you know, that is, it takes a long time to recover, if ever, you know, if that's the case, right? So understand, you have the cadence of understanding the model, understanding how to forecast your business, being able to call the numbers, being able to build a beat and raise framework over, you know, ideally 3 to 4 years as you look out. So, you know, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
That's fascinating. What about M&A? Both in your personal experience, professional experience, looking at them in the past, what went well, what doesn't or didn't go well? And in today's world, you know, if someone was contemplating M&A, what should they be thinking about?
Yeah, so look, I believe you should never try to build a company for sale or try to manage a company for sale. You know, so ideally, your company should be acquired, it shouldn't be sold. And there's a distinctive difference, obviously, between the two. The things you can do to really smoothen that process, facilitate that process, is, again, managing a best-in-class operations. Just having a clean house, clean shop, and ensuring that if your audits are clean, Alex, you know, if you're able to hand an acquirer, here are my audited financials from day one, from EY, PwC, KPMG, you name it, it's completely sort of clean. Here are the books, the records, you know, our contracts, et cetera, et cetera. It really, number one, it builds the confidence that the acquirer has in the acquiring company. Okay, these guys have their processes all sorted out. They're a well-operated outfit. And it takes the risk. It takes a lot of the risk off the table in a transaction as well. And so, because you get asked questions like, okay, can you give us a list of non-standard deals or terms and conditions that you've agreed to in your enterprise sort of contract? So we understand the implications if there's a change in control. And so being able to say straight off the bat, here is a report that we can generate from our ERP or if our CRM system that shows you, here's a list of customers with non-standard terms and conditions, and these are the condition, you know, and so on. So the more of that you have available or easily available to get to, and having, you know, even things like the offers for employees or your option agreements and your equity plans and all of that straightened out, because some of those things can really slow down the ultimate, you know, consummation of an M&A deal. If you're trying to track down, you know, a shareholder for approval or a group of shareholders for approval, and, you know, you don't have all the paperwork or you can't seem to find people and these kinds of things, right? So having the books, the records, and so on. And ultimately, it's, you know, growing your business, managing your business in a way that, you know, operate as if you're looking to build a standalone, sustainable, big company. Understand the reason that someone is interested in your company. Are they trying to buy you because of the sales you have, you know, the revenue you have? Are they trying to buy you because of the technology, you know, the IP you've built? Are you of strategic importance to them? And so on and so forth. And then obviously, you know, you want to emphasize that and market that as part of the deal negotiation. So really understanding the motivation of the buyer. As an example, you know, a lot of companies say, well, our ARR is $100 million. Therefore, the price should be a multiple of the $100 million. Well, I say, hang on, not necessarily. Because the question to ask yourself is, how much ARR is that acquirer? You know, how much ARR are they going to be able to generate if they had the product from your company in the portfolio in the hands of their sales organization? And if that 100 is going to grow to $500 million in 2 years, then the conversation should really be about how much is $500 million of ARR, how much, you know, what is the worth of that to you, acquirer, in 2 years, right? So changing the narrative of the conversation to say, you know, the value of this company in the hands of an acquirer is, you know, I think is much more interesting.
Yeah, 100%. So it's synergies accretion, right? Or maybe dilution, right? If things go south.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. And just curious, when you do consummate an M&A transaction, whose job is it to integrate the ultimate kind of consummation of the merger of two companies or more? Does it fall into ops? Does it fall into every single group? Does it fall into the CFO suite? Who manages that?
Are you asking from the standpoint of the acquirer? So if I'm acquiring...
Yeah, generally.
Yeah. I've seen it handled differently in different companies. Even the integration question. I mean, I'll go, you know, way back in early on in my experience, I worked at Trimble. Trimble was a a very small, I think, a version of GE. It is a conglomerate of companies, highly acquisitive. So I was the VP, Chief Accounting Officer at Trimble, and we did about a deal every quarter on average. So during the tenure there, we bought about 20 companies. That's a lot. And we did not have a dedicated M&A team or a dedicated M&A group. So in that scenario, a lot of the work, everything from the initial work, the diligence, and then a lot of the subsequent integration of ERP systems or HR practices and the finance stuff, the burden was on the CFO's organization, the finance team, right? So me and my team during that time. And then I've, some of the larger companies, when I was at Clearwell on the other side of the transaction, Symantec had acquired us. And I remember at the time, Symantec had a dedicated team of a group of people whose job was actually to integrate, acquisitions that they had made, and it was a whole team of people that would be the conduit to different organizations inside of Symantec and really helping with that integration. So I think it depends on the company, but I've seen the gamut of it. But regardless of the exact sort of route and outcome, it is for sure the finance organization is absolutely key and play a significant a role in that process. All the way, the gamut is from doing everything to doing a large amount of it. So it's a broad spread.
Yeah, got it. There you go. Very cool. Switching gears one last time. Would love to hear your views on just, the industry, the practice, right, of the CFO's responsibility of the finance organization. And in particular, I understand you have some very strong views about GAAP versus non-GAAP metrics and SEC filings and just how the industry should be reporting their metrics. So would love to discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, no. So I'm sure you've heard me on this one, at some point in the past. But, look, I think obviously we operate in a world where, GAAP is king, right? So GAAP is absolutely essential, important. You need to be consistent and accurate in reporting the revenue and cash flow statements and really the net income of your business. So it helps for the purposes of consistency and comparing the results across, industries and companies. Looking at the business drivers and indicators that drive the value of companies, I think investors often look beyond the GAAP numbers and metrics, right? And in some cases, they look at metrics that may not even be a financial metric at all. The one that comes to mind, it's been all over the news, is if you take a company such as like a Netflix as an example, right? And the valuation of Netflix, the gyrations in the stock price of Netflix almost entirely comes down to the number of subscribers they've either acquired or they've lost in a given quarter.
Yep.
And I think we saw in the recent announcement that, the street was expecting them to lose 2 million subscribers, but it turned out that, they lost only a million. So the stock, then it popped the following day. It wasn't as bad as you thought, right? So the subscriber, metric is probably the most important thing that everyone who invests in Netflix and care about Netflix, they look at. If you're looking at like a Tesla, you're looking at the number of cars you manufacture and ship every quarter as a metric that is really, really key. So, some of these are non-financial indicators, but they indicate the health, they're a leading indicator of the revenue and metrics that are ultimately are going to show up in GAAP the statement. So in that case, the question I have or the point I would like to make is that, is there a consistency of definitions of some of these things? For example, when you talk about subscribers at Netflix, do we know if Amazon, Disney, Pandora, and Spotify, all of whom do a reporting of subscribers, as Netflix does, are they all recording, defining, doing the measurement of subscribers the same way? I mean, how do you do the count of, the multiple individuals who might be sharing a password, as an example, right? So I think if subscribers are a metric, you know, the point I make is, and this isn't necessarily a, you know, a regulatory thing, but is there a framework that every, you know, the big companies or key companies can agree to as to here's how we define subscribers? I think if I bring that closer to home and I think about, you know, the world of enterprise software or the SaaS world, and I think of ARR, and I think of, you know, the net retention, you know, NRR, churn, you know, these kind of metrics, I know for a fact that different companies define these metrics in different ways. I've even seen some companies that use a, you know, a consumption model, which is a usage-based. I mean, Snowflake is a prime example. And if you look at the investor deck from Snowflake on slide number one, they say, we are not a SaaS company, right? They're a consumption-based model. Investors, though, try to then look at the revenue for Snowflake and convert that into some ARR, implied ARR, using a consumption. So again, ARR, and by definition, if you have a consumption approach and model, I mean, you don't have ARR. It isn't a contractual thing. So I think I've seen how some companies, when they report a churn number, they basically say a churn is every account we've lost in a period, excluding, for example, the downsells you may get from existing customers. I have tended to take a conservative approach and say, well, I think I define a churn as everything that decreases ARR. So regardless of if it's a downsell, a lost customer, whatever. So there are several interpretations of the non-GAAP indicators, ARR, NRR, churn, et cetera, et cetera. And so the point I have made is, you know, if I was chairman of SEC for a day, or, you know, I would look hard at how some of these non-GAAP indicators and metrics are being defined and measured and reported, because I think investors and stakeholders generally, we tend to place a great amount of emphasis on these non-GAAP, you know, metrics as opposed to the GAAP stuff. I mean, the common one you hear about is, you know, how the treatment of stock-based compensation. Some companies include it in, you know, to report their GAAP earnings. The vast, you know, majority of companies, certainly in this area, exclude it from their earnings, right? And again, the comparability becomes very difficult. So yes, I've got some views on this.
Definitely.
On
it's this interesting though, also just because, you know, I spent the prior decade of my career as an investor. That's also where you have some alpha opportunity, right? Because that's now it's the analyst's job, right?
Right.
Whether it's, you know, sell side, buy side, hedge fund investor, it's their job to see through that, right? And just say, hey, well, I'm going to make my own modification and adjustments to make sure that a churn at Ramp versus a churn at Illumio versus a churn at Netflix could be looked at, you know, on a more like-for-like basis.
It is. The challenge, though, is there is asymmetric information. You know, there's asymmetric information because as an external analyst or an investor, you don't have access to all of the details, all of the information. And frankly speaking, I don't think you have the time because you have your coverage of 25 companies, 30 companies, even more. And so there is literally a maximum amount of time you can invest in trying to parse through and get under the hood of every single company in the coverage space that you're tracking, right? So there is asymmetric information.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think there's probably a happy medium, right, where the SEC does a little bit more. I think industry certainly can do a little bit more self-regulation and self-standardization.
Yeah.
That definitely makes sense. Anoop, you've been very, very generous with your time. I'm going to leave you with one last question before we wrap up. You know, 2022 has been a pretty crazy year already. For the next, you know, 6 or 7 months, what are you most optimistic about? You know, what are you looking forward to for yourself, professionally, for Illumio, for the markets, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a great question, Alex. I mean, look, I would say I'm an eternal optimist. So that's, you know, the first thing. I think from a young age, I've always had a tendency to believe that the future is bright and it's, you know, it's going to be bright. That's why I've lived in three continents and, you know, have seized the adventures that I have. And I think I'm really excited to be, especially in the San Francisco, you know, Bay Area, Silicon Valley. I think all the rumors about, you know, the death of Silicon Valley are greatly exaggerated, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
I think the innovation I see every day, it is it's mind blowing, you know, just being around here. I drive into work and I'm surrounded by, you know, cars that are on the road next to me. They're actually either autonomous cars being, you know, going through a test period here, you know, the investments that are going into EVs that are going to help the climate, the environment, just the innovation in the cloud, you know, to see as transformation is continuing. Artificial intelligence is just a big, big area that I also think has huge implications for our industry. And, you know, we'll have a conversation about that a different day and the implications of AI. So the chats I have with, you know, the kids around the table in the evening is we're living in a renaissance period as far as innovation and the genius around here we see every day. And it isn't something I take for granted. So I think it is super exciting. I see tons of innovation that is really going to make the world a better place. I think, look, we're going to get through this period, the tough period. We've been through it a number of times in the past, you know, and it isn't ever as good as it seems sometimes, and it isn't ever as bad as it seems as well. You know, so I think we're going to get through this, and I believe in the future of this country, and I believe in the future of this area and the future of all the innovation I see in tech that's going on right now. I'm super excited.
That's phenomenal. Ever the optimist. There you have it. That's a great note to leave this on. That's awesome. Anoop Singh, CFO of Illumio. Thanks so much once again for joining the podcast. Thanks so much.
Great to chat. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Recession Proof is brought to you by Ramp. To find out more about Ramp and how we can help you control spend, save time, and automate busy work, visit ramp.com. And then make sure to search for Recession Proof in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Ramp, thanks for listening.